Session number 12778.
And I'm Martin Reel 19.
Well, I'm sure we're going to have a disaster of some sort. I then telephoned Ronnie McAllister and told him that his small garrison was going to have to stick it out. He replied, "In that case, we shall just have to be extra alert." Well, at 23:30 hours, after the garrison had been under siege for 9 hours, disaster did strike. The coolies made a determined effort to try and pull away the wire around the post. On the Hong Kong side, and while the garrison was engaged in repelling this attempt, another party crossed the bridge, attached grappling hooks to the wire at the end of the compound nearest the bridge, which was in darkness, and suddenly the small garrison found the compound behind them full of men armed with axes, cargo hooks, and pistols. Hearing the commotion behind him, Ronnie McAllister turned round to see that Trevor Bedford had a knife at his throat and one of our police officers had a pistol at his head. Colonel McAllister had about 3 seconds to decide what to do. He realised instantly that any offensive action he took would result in the immediate deaths of Bedford and the police officer. And the next moment he too had a pistol at his head. Back at my brigade headquarters, I had heard a running commentary on what was taking place from the Gurkha defence position on the top of Mankanto Hill. The immediate reaction of the company commander there was to move the soldiers down the hill to try and effect an immediate rescue. But the coolies thrust a loud hailer into Trevor Bedford's hands and told him to shout to the soldiers that if they came any nearer, the hostages would be killed. Bedford also shouted that he wanted to be given time to try and talk his way out of the situation. Well, there then followed a most agonising night. I got the second in command of the 1st 10th Gurkha Rifles to make a plan with 2 companies to prevent at any cost the abduction of the garrison across the bridge, but that's all we could do for the time being. At about 2:30 in the morning, I spoke to the commander of British Forces, General Sir John Worsley, and said I felt we had got to restore the situation before first light. The Chinese army was still in full battle order on the other side of the bridge, and I felt that if we had to try and effect a rescue in daylight, the Chinese army would be bound to intervene and at point-blank range. I therefore asked permission to move in on the bridge while it was still dark, in full recognition of the fact that some or all of the hostages might be killed in the process. Well, permission for me to take this action didn't arrive until 4:15 hours. And as the 2 companies of the 1st 10th started to move, Trevor Bedford again spoke on the loud hailer. He said he had signed a piece of paper under duress, making all the promises and apologies required, and that they were about to be released. He said there is now no point in any bloodshed and asked us not to move any further. 15 minutes later, after a great deal of photographing, they were indeed released with their weapons, and this appalling, undignified affair was over. The pictures taken that night by the Chinese communists appeared in the world's press. Poor Ronnie McAllister was very distressed. He was quite one of the best commanding officers in the army. And in trying to console him, I pointed out that no territory had been lost, no weapons had been lost, there had been no bloodshed, and that all that had been lost was face. I told him that wretched as he must feel at the moment, I was quite sure that in 6 months' time, when he could look back on events more calmly, he would realise that it had been better to suffer the indignity he had than to have a highly successful slaughter, which could have resulted in lasting bitterness and great loss of life on the border. Well, the immediate reaction of government to the Mankanto incident was to order us to close the border forthwith, with the exception of Lo Wu. And we pointed out that it was impossible to close the border because the border fence had long fallen into disrepair. We were told, nevertheless, that we had got to close it. It was a simple matter to put a barbed wire barricade on the bridge of Mankanto, and a simple matter to close the various gates which were the official access to Hong Kong from China. But true to our forecast, all that happened was that the farmers from the other side streamed through holes in the fence and were soon at work in their fields as if nothing had ever happened. We did attempt to return one part of their own territory, but the wind was strong, gas was ineffective, and the attempt was abortive. In the early afternoon, government agreed that with the exception of Mankanto, the border should be reopened, and the farmers at Taku Ling were then told they were not working illegally in their fields after all. They asked very reasonably that the gate over the footbridge at Taku Ling be reopened, so they could go back to their village across the border that way and collect some more tools. And a small party of policemen and soldiers went down to open the gate and were promptly set upon by the farmers. We had all the ingredients of another Mankanto situation. However, on this occasion, I didn't ask for authority to disperse the farmers, and rapid police military action restored the situation, although in the course of the action, one police officer was severely injured and his Sterling gun stolen, and one Gurkha drew blood with his cookery. As the soldiers and policemen pulled back from the bridge after dispersing the farmers onto their own territory, Chinese soldiers and militia who'd been lining the Chinese side of the river opened fire with their machine guns some 15 yards to the flank of the Gurkha soldiers. Well, this was the first time fire had been opened since Shattuck Kok, and because it was not effective fire, there was no need to fire back. Well, I felt it was inevitable that trouble would now spread back against Shattuck Kok, where posters had also been removed by the police from the walls of San Lau Street, the border shopping centre. In one house in this street, the 1st 7th Gurkhas had a military OP looking across the border, and the opposition knew it was there. On the morning of the 12th of August, a party of 100 people ran across the border, broke down the wooden shutters and the metal grill, the entrance to the OP building, to get the Gurkha soldiers. Section commander put on their gas masks and waited with gas grenades ready. As soon as the mob burst into the building, the grenades were thrown, and in that confined space were highly effective. Gasping for breath and vomiting, the crowd poured out onto the jetty to get away from the gas. The commanding officer of the 1st 7th Gurkhas immediately made a broadcast telling the crowd that unless they dispersed back onto their own territory forthwith, he would open fire. Whereupon the Chinese soldiers on their own side of the border summoned the back crowd back into China. In the course of 9 days, therefore, we had had two successful gas actions at Lo Wu and Shattuck Kok. The Mankanto Tea Party were honours for perhaps even the disaster at Mankanto and an undignified scramble at Taku Ling. And the time had come to take stock. The lessons we felt from Mankanto and Taku Ling was that soldiers and policemen must never be manoeuvred into a position against the border fence or border crossing points again. And the border should be defended from a series of defended localities and police posts 100 yards or so back from the border. Under this system, there would be no direct control of people coming across the border, but the border itself would be controlled. And if coolies from the other side wanted to have a physical clash with security forces, they would have to do so on ground of our choosing rather than on theirs. This plan was accepted, and a number of defended localities were dug, some of which, with the more isolated police posts, were also surrounded by mines. We decided against the construction of a new border fence at this time, because the wire would have to go across the fields owned by farmers from China, and the erection of such a fence would merely have led to yet further trouble. We knew, both from the Mankamto coolies themselves and from other sources, that Chinese villagers on the border had instructions to support their impressed compatriots in Hong Kong. They'd been given no guidelines as to how to do this, and it was left to their own initiative. The Chinese army and the swarm of 30 border regiment were completely powerless to stop the local militia and villagers from initiating incidents. One has to remember that in China, decisions are ultimately made by the masses, and while the army or other authority could advise against militant action, it was the masses in the shape of the local village population who made the final decision of whether to take action or not. If the popular vote was for militant action against the British, the Chinese army would then be told that if they did not support this action, they were traitors to the masses. The army was indeed in a very difficult position. Well, the aim of the militia and villagers was, we believe, to try and get the Chinese army actively involved in battle with us. And indeed, the Chinese communist press in Peking and Hong Kong was constantly calling for solidarity between the Chinese army and the masses in China and Hong Kong against the Hong Kong British. Chinese communist papers in Hong Kong, Chinese communist leaders in Hong Kong were constantly forecasting that at any moment the Chinese army would march. And the Chinese government in Peking was already making demands on the Hong Kong government. Perhaps they had been told not to create incidents themselves, but the Chinese villagers adopted the tactics now of seizing upon pretext that we had provoked them, and our removal of posters was a splendid source of provocation. Having learned that we would tear down any inflammatory posters on our side of the border, they deliberately put up posters for us to pull down so that they would have a legitimate excuse for indignant reaction. We therefore decided that in future we would not react blindly to every provocation, and that where inflammatory posters could only inflame those who put them up, we wouldn't pull them down immediately but would bide our time. We resolved also to try and avoid any other form of provocation. Our real worry, if we were to avoid bloodshed, which I felt was important, was the fact that we could only escalate from gas to bullets without any intermediate stage. I had some experts out from England to see whether it was possible for them to produce what the police in America were using, which was called instant banana skin, which was some form of spray which created an icy surface and which any rioting people would fall flat on their backs, which I thought might be quite helpful. We also discussed such things as the use of silent Sten guns, so we could perhaps fire at ringleaders without them being aware that it was we ourselves who had fired. But none of these ideas came to very much. And I decided, therefore, in talks with my COs, that on the next occasion when force was necessary and gas was ineffective, we would use phosphorus smoke grenades. If you stand too close to a phosphorus grenade when it explodes, you suffer nasty burns. But it seemed to me it was still better to hurt, to burn someone, rather than to shoot him. I knew full well that if I asked for permission to use phosphorus grenades, it would be impossible for the political advisor to agree this weapon. It would be too much like using chemical warfare or napalm. And so I made no mention of my intentions to land for headquarters land forces. I agreed with my commanding officers that if they had to use phosphorus grenades, they would report that they were having to move soldiers from one place to another under the cover of smoke from their phosphorus grenades. I have no doubt I was thoroughly wrong in taking this decision off my own bat, but phosphorus grenades were on this occasion to prove the ideal anti-riot weapon. One thing that was really bad was intelligence. Admittedly, we had had warning that there was going to be trouble of some sort at Shattercock on the 8th of July, but we had no inkling of the events at other points on the border, and we resolved this must be put right. There was intelligence of major movements in China, well back from the border, but nothing about the border itself. We obtained rapid agreement to the formation of a special branch unit for the border, which I hope is now still paying dividends. But it takes time to build up the necessary network of informers and agents. So I tried to get permission to have places where the farmers worked and drank their mid-morning tea and talked, bugged, so we can know what they were talking about. But this permission for this was refused, which was a great pity. Well, as August moved slowly along, we had to await events. There were those who thought the trouble was perhaps over, but on the 17th of August, a circular was issued by parties of Chinese militia bearing such title as the Anti-British Fighting Army Group, the headquarters of the Frontline Militiamen, the Explosion Damage Troop of the Fighting Group, and the headquarters of the Red Vanguards, all warning our policemen on the frontier, and the Gurkha soldiers in particular, that the militiamen were about to administer a fatal attack, and that the policemen and Gurkhas, when the attack came, should move aside and refuse to join in any defensive measures. If they didn't, they would have to face the consequences. There was also propaganda at this time against the governor of Nepal for allowing Gurkha soldiers to operate on the border. Well, we had decided to try and avoid doing anything which could possibly be considered as provocation, but provoke them we did. On the 24th of August, a party of press correspondents on a border tour went down with their conducting officer to Lo Wu Station. They had been expressly forbidden to go beyond the police post or right onto the railway line, but a small party evaded their conducting officer, went forward into the immigration compound and out onto the line to take pictures down by the bridge. At this moment, a party of female farm workers crossed their bridge on their way to work in the fields on our side. They were absolutely infuriated at having their photographs taken, and they pursued the photographers into the immigration compound, the gate of which couldn't be locked because of the melee in the entrance. Well, we immediately cleared all civilians out of the immigration compound, but not before one press man had lost his tape recorder. And there then followed a siege of the immigration compound, which went on until darkness fell. At first, the Chinese army attempted to stop the rioters crossing the bridge, but they were brushed aside, and in fact, some of them were beaten to the ground by the angry crowd. And a Chinese officer then came down to the bridge and withdrew his soldiers completely. They took no further interest in proceedings at Lo Wu until the following evening. Gas was ineffective against the crowds, some of whom were wearing respirators or masks and were equipped with buckets of water and long-handled shovels to deal with gas grenades. The company commander therefore decided to use phosphorus grenades, and about 16 of the crowd were badly burned, as photographs in the communist press later showed. In retaliation, the rioters tried to set fire to the immigration compound with petrol bombs. Later, three attacks were made against the immigration compound with stick grenades, one of which blew a hole in the roof, but no soldiers were injured. Simultaneously, the Chinese army opened fire from what was called Wireless Hill, just back 100 yards over the Chinese side of the border, and bullets thudded into the roof of the immigration compound. The attacks on the immigration compound started again at first light on the 25th of August, but the attackers no longer came in crowds after their burning. They came in small parties of three or four, making use of ground in a good guerrilla warfare way. What had started a riot had indeed developed into a form of guerrilla warfare. Now, I said earlier that we had tried to pass messages to the Chinese army to try and obtain their cooperation, but because our broadcast could be overheard by the civil population, they were not entirely successful. And I said we'd eventually discovered a good method of communicating with the Chinese army. We discovered this, in fact, on that second day of the trouble, Lo Wu, overlooking the station. On top of a hill known as Crest Hill was a Royal Artillery OP. And during the 25th of August operation, Crest Hill OP reported on radio on the brigade net, wireless net, that four men had swum the river from the Chinese side and were crawling along behind a low embankment armed with stick grenades, and obviously trying to get as close as possible to the police post on our side. On the same brigade wireless net, I immediately ordered the 1st 10th Gurkham Rifles to send a patrol light to try and capture these men. The progress of the Chinese guerrillas and the patrol trying to find them was reported every few minutes on the brigade net. Suddenly a man was seen racing down the riverbank on the Chinese side. He leapt into the river, swam across, and bent double, raced along to where the assaulting party was, passed them an urgent message, and together the whole party raced back to the river and swam across to safety. And it seemed to me that the Chinese army were listening in to our brigade wireless net and had realized the situation and had called the attack off. And thereafter, whenever I wanted the Chinese army alerted to a dangerous situation, I would summon one of my commanding officers to the radio and tell him what I thought was likely to happen. If, for example, there was evidence of trouble brewing at Mankum Toe, I would tell the commanding officer on the radio that I expected trouble there, and that if there was trouble, he had a free hand to open fire. But I hoped that there would not be trouble, because I was quite sure the Chinese army wouldn't approve, and that I believed the Chinese army was as anxious to keep the peace as we were. And 30 minutes later, a platoon of Chinese soldiers would arrive at Mankum Toe, or wherever the trouble, suspected trouble was, at the double, and would take over control. And that system worked admirably, except Shattercock, which was unfortunately under a different army command. Well, on the 24th and 25th of August, while we had been having the trouble at Lo Wu, we had the second battle of Mankum Toe. As I said, the bridge at Mankum Toe had been blocked with a dannet wire barrier. And on the morning of the 24th of August, attempts were made by the coolies, who of course were denied from taking their produce across into Hong Kong by the bridge being closed. Attempts were made by them to try and pull the barbed wire barrier away. And they kept getting hit by phosphorus grenades, and then they tried to advance on the barrier across the bridge under cover of great bales of straw, but those were destroyed by fire. But they came on and on again, and on this day there was considerable shooting from across the other side by the Chinese army at our platoon position on the high ground overlooking the bridge. I had started a system of having independent broadcasters watching these operations and reporting back directly on my brigade net, so that the people who were fighting the battle were free to fight the battle without being called on, called up on the radio by me and asked for explanation of what was happening. So I was getting running commentaries from both Mancombe Toe and Lo Wu by these independent observers. And one of them reported that the bullets were going a foot over the head of the soldiers, the Gurkha soldiers on the top of the Mancombe Toe Ridge. And later in the day, I said to the company commander, Major Bruce Niven, who was not only a very distinguished soldier, but a very, very clever one too, I said to him, I was rather surprised you didn't open fire yourselves when you were having bullets clipping the twigs a foot or so above your head. He said that it wasn't effective fire. None of us got hit. No point in answering the fire. But down on the barricade, on the bridge, the situation got worse and worse. The coolies would make dash after dash and across, grab a little bit of wire and pull it away. And so the barrier was gradually being beaten down. And on the second day, the 25th of August, they managed to get grappling hooks attached to the barbed wire barrier to pull it away. And one extremely gallant Gurkha soldier who had been standing on his own behind this barrier, throwing phosphorus grenades over, then drew his kukri and just slashed all the grappling ropes one after the other, until eventually they did succeed in clearing all the obstacles. Whereupon the platoon, the Gurkha platoon from the top of the hill, lined up on the bridge with their rifles at the ready, and the coolies eventually slunk away. They didn't dare try a final go. But it was a very, very busy 2 days, both at Lo Wu and Mancombe Toe. We had now got to the stage where the Mancombe Toe barrier had been virtually removed. I had ordered the construction of a brand new barrier for Mancombe Toe, later to be used and called Hadrian's Wall, which was a 12-foot high steel barrier made portable on wheels so that we could move it down to the bridge at a moment's notice and drop it there. But that wasn't yet ready. So it seemed to me that if we were to regain the initiative, probably the answer was now to open the bridge forthwith. The Mancombe coolies would certainly not be expecting this and might be somewhat bemused. So having lost our obstacle really, the new one not being open, we would make the best of it by officially declaring the bridge open again. And that's what happened. And they were totally...